Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. For years, doctors have communicated with patients via phone and mail. Now, some doctors are conversing via social media, like email, texting, tweeting, and even Facebook. One of those doctors leading this medical social media revolution is Dr. Natasha Burgert in Kansas City. A question for the doctor? A quick text can often do the trick and even help patients avoid needless doctor's appointments. Some patients even say that tweeting and texting makes their doctors feel more human to them and people that patients can confide in. Today we'll talk about this big change in doctor communication. With us is Dr. Natasha Burgert, who's with Pediatric Associates of Kansas City. Dr. Natasha, so good to have you here. Good morning.
Thank you so much.
Dr. Jason Newland is also here. He's a pediatric infectious diseases specialist at Children's Mercy. Jason, nice to have you too.
Thanks for having me.
And Josh Harrigan is here. He's a medical student at the KU School of Medicine who's working on innovative tech ideas to improve care. And Josh, nice to have you too.
Great to be here.
Well, Dr. Natasha, you started down this path about 3 years ago. What got you going on this thing?
Well, I originally started thinking about social media as an idea to communicate different issues and essentially solve a problem that I was having.
Which was?
As a pediatrician, I see my kiddos for 20 minutes every year on an annual checkup. And there is so much that happens in health that's important for me to share during those other 364 days.
Yeah.
So I started in social simply to solve that problem, which is trying to get information, reliable information, out to my patients when I couldn't see them.
And that's kind of broad information that might be applicable to lots of the kids you see, right?
Well, I see a wide range of ages, everywhere from newborns to kids graduating from college. So there's always something to talk about.
And the people begin to pick up on this? How did it begin to evolve here?
It evolved by word of mouth very quickly. So my patients, I think, found great value in being able to connect with me in a very unique place, and a place that they already were. We know that the vast majority of Americans are using the internet for information, and a third of them use the internet to find healthcare information. And so I'm joining them there to join in that journey, so to speak.
Well, how did you get involved with tweeting and texting and sort of a more personalized one-on-one communication with some of your patients?
Slowly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I started with a blog called Casey Kids Doc, which rotated into using Facebook, which rolled into using Twitter, and then started with texting. So it was kind of an evolving process over about a year and a half, because I found that each of those social media tools each had a different purpose and a different group that they were reaching. And I felt that my job as a physician was to be able to adapt to the different places that they were in order to get the same message across.
Dr. Jason Newland, I'm wondering what your colleagues are saying about this new idea, because I imagine for, like anyone in society, for older docs, this might be a paradigm shift they're not comfortable with, and others just might fear it because they fear an avalanche of text and tweets every day that'll keep you from making the rounds that you've got to make.
You know, I think it's a great question, because at Children's Mercy, I've gotten into this space a little bit, actually going to Natasha and talked to her probably about a year and a half ago and noticing that impact. And we've brought it to Children's Mercy some and started introducing it. I know Natasha's come to speak to our medical residents. Josh and I have actually talked to our medical residents about this impact. But I think you hit the nail, you know, you really hit it nicely in that there's still a big intrepidation. How do we use it? What's the safety in use it? We actually, I think Josh and I talking to the residents, one resident was very, very fearful of the medical legal risk that one might put themselves at by being out there and saying, well, what about this? And what if you don't get back to them right away and something bad happens? What do you do? And so that, I think those are some of the fears that have been, especially among, you know, the academic center or that, you know, that big freestanding children's hospital.
You know, Josh, it wasn't 6 months ago that I got a handwritten note from my physician that was snail mailed to me at my home about an issue in my family. And that begins to tell you the range of stuff still going on out there. How do you think this new way is hitting a lot of doctors? Is it going to pick up and broaden pretty dramatically, or what do you anticipate here?
So as a medical student, I get to rotate around from a lot of different medical practices, and I get to see everything from doctors who are still relying solely on paper charts and communicating through snail mail with their patients to doctors like Natasha that are embracing all the newest technologies and using these. I think what I see for current medical students and their use right now is that they are using social media and engaging with it, but not necessarily through their medical education or medical practice yet. It's more of kind of a social space instead of being a tool that they could really use to communicate with their colleagues and with patients.
And do you see that evolving and changing as time goes on? Because given Natasha's success and given the sort of the thrust of society these days, you wonder if all this just isn't simply inevitable.
Well, I think we're going to see a big range because within a given medical school class that's currently in training, you have people that have a broad range of their adoption of technologies. You have students that are taking paper notes all the way up to students who use absolutely zero paper and communicate through email and everything like that.
So the revolution going on out in society is also hitting what you guys are dealing with every day then, it sounds
sure.
like.
Yeah. Sure.
I'd like to say that I think it's a really important thing about knowing that where Josh is coming from in this and from the education realm. And I think for people that are into the education of these students, it's be maybe short-sighted of us if we don't think that this is going to change the way we practice medicine. I mean, I think it's short-sighted of us to think that this might not change us to be better at healthcare. I mean, we know there's a lot of problems out in healthcare. You've seen numbers, 100,000 lives affected a year because of medical mistakes. I mean, these tools, these social media tools, other technology tools have to be implemented, have to be used and learned about so that we can figure out a way to make our healthcare system better.
And I don't think we'll be able to have a choice coming up soon with meaningful use requirements and other changes that are happening with government changes. I mean, it's going to be required for physicians to have electronic access with their patients. This will no longer be a choice. And
I'm not sure I'm following you here. What change are you talking about that will be required of doctors to catch on?
Meaningful use requirements are going to come out, which is going to be part of the government package in order to kind of guide what are going to be best practices for the nation as a whole in healthcare. Mm-hmm. And one of their missions is to increase transparency, increase the amount that patients will have access to their records and access to their physicians. And an easy way to do that is through electronic communications, which will be part of those requirements.
You know, Josh, I'm just wondering, at the medical school that you attend, what are your professors saying about this and how much are they emphasizing it? Are they embracing it or are they, you know, sort of standoffish in their attitude towards it?
So I think the current attitude is more or less neutral. Nobody is necessarily embracing it and becoming huge cheerleaders of it. At the same time, they just don't really talk much about it. And there's no, aside from some cautionary tales about what you should and should not be doing in the social space, there's not a whole lot of guidance, even going all the way up to like the American Association of Medical Colleges. They have issued very little guidance and very little education for medical schools to follow.
Well, Dr. Newland, before we get too far into this, there are some drawbacks here that you've already hit on a couple that immediately begin to come to mind here. One of them is this expectation from patients who have doctors who are big on social media of a doctor suddenly being on call 24/7, literally 7 days a week, literally 24 hours a day. That expectation is going to be there pretty quickly, isn't it?
It is. I mean, I think that is an expectation that's there. I think as I would say for me, and I think Natasha can even speak to this better because she does this every day, I think we all in some respects feel obligated to our patients most of the time. Now, I think we sometimes as physicians think, oh, if we get into this space, we're going to be bothered by our patients all the time. The reality of it is they actually understand too. They understand that we're busy people. They almost feel bad if they're bothering you all the time. I've actually probably seen more of someone apologizing for paging me when I'm on call on the weekend, say, oh, I'm so sorry to talk to you, but.
Well, I feel that way. If I have to call pediatric associates on the weekends, I always feel like, oh, gosh, I hate to be doing this.
But, but that's what we're there for.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we're there for. So this fear, I think, among the physicians and the clinicians that do this of, oh, we're going to be inundated and now we're always on call and we're always there. You know what? I would disagree. Now, that's from a guy that sits up somewhat in an ivory tower and works as an administrator and does some things that's not in a clinic like Natasha. But that's how I've always viewed it.
Natasha, what's been your experience? I mean, how's it worked out for you in terms of being on call, feeling like you're on call 24/7?
Well, I never got into medicine to have a 9-to-5 job. And especially when you're dealing with little kids and dealing in pediatrics, kids get sick at night. Our patients need us at night, and they need to have that access. Not that I want them to be calling me for every single issue, but I honestly think that our patients are so desperate to connect with physicians that they understand that being able to tweet me, being able to text me, being able to send an email is a privilege, and it's respected. With a thriving practice that I have, I rarely get more than one or two emails a day, and most physicians would never believe that to be true. But it is something that my patients don't want to have taken away from them so they don't abuse it.
I was going to say, though, it would only take one or two or three patients who sort of want Dr. Natasha to be, you know, to answer questions at weird times to sort of mess up your life pretty quickly, though.
When I leave the office at 5 o'clock, I rarely have my computer open, honestly.
Your phone?
My phone. I'll check before I go to bed when my kids go to sleep. But after I go home from work, I'm there for my family, and I'm there to do a little bit of work. But this is not like I'm a habitual phone checker or constantly responding to these messages. The vast majority of what I receive are non-urgent issues, parents just seeking advice or my take on an issue that could be handled the next day, and they're very pleased whenever they get a response, whether that's 20 minutes or 2 days.
So you're not getting texts from patients who are a parent saying, you know, my son or daughter is throwing up repeatedly, it's 10 o'clock at night, I don't know what to do, I need a response from you right now, Dr. Natasha.
That doesn't happen to me because of the environment in which I work. At Pediatric Associates, we have great access. We've got someone in the office 7 days a week. And so our patients know that if there's an urgency, if they really want
the
patient
to call you.
No, they can go to the office. Somebody's going to be there. That luxury doesn't apply to all physicians by far, and so their experience may be different. But for where I work, it works perfectly.
If you're just joining us this morning, you're listening to Up to Date, and we're talking about this big revolution, this big change in doctor communication, doctors more and more using email, texting, tweeting, and Facebook. And we're wondering, what do you make of this new trend of doctors using social media? How would you like to get texts from your doctor? Give us a phone call here, 816-235-2888. You can also email us at uptodate@kcur.org or tweet us at @kcuruptodate. We can also go to KCUR's Facebook page. Another drawback, Josh, that's been mentioned is this notion of why should I have to visit my doc if I can just email her or text her? I begin to wonder about, you do need a revenue flow into the office. People don't have to pay doctors' visits if they're just texting their doctor. What about that concern that I'm sure many doctors also share here?
Yeah, it's been a concern that's been expressed quite a bit because doctors are worried they're going to get caught up returning a lot of emails, getting no reimbursement or no payment for doing so, and it's taking up a significant portion of their day where they're not spending time talking to patients. The fact of the matter is that you can use social media to be proactive and put out information and take care of some patient questions before they come into the office to ask you, and so you can redirect your time to actually taking care of sicker patients.
But there's a conflict there, though, in some cases, right? Not to get too crass here, but by offering free information, like the newspaper does, you're not getting paid for offering that free information. And I know some of that sort of goes with the job, but at some point, that'll be a concern, right?
So I think as healthcare professionals, we just want to make sure that our patients have correct information and the best information. And I think that's why the people sitting around us here are so interested in engaging in social media, is because there are a lot of people out there putting out a lot of information. And we want to be able to control some of that information and make sure that our patients are reading accurate information.
Hey, and I would also make the argument that we still aren't saying that, you know, though social media is important and helps with our communication, there's still something about the patient, the family, coming to your office and seeing them.
Mm-hmm.
That's still we're not saying let's not doctor in that respect. I mean, the history and physical exam is still a major part of what we do. I would argue, and I don't have any data to show to prove this, that this communication, this ability to kind of have more interaction with your patients leads to probably maybe more visits in some respects that are beneficial. We use resources better. And likely our outcomes turn out to be better. We've had the opportunity, Josh and I, meeting with Dr. Peter Margolis, who's from the Cincinnati Children's Medical Center, and where actually Dr. Natasha trained. And he is in charge of a large inflammatory bowel disease network, a network that spans over 45 other hospitals that are taking care of these kids, children that have conditions such as Crohn's disease, ulcerative colitis.
Mm-hmm.
And they've done a lot of work on a network basis to say, hey, what can we do for these patients and help them not have more visits to the hospital, more what we call remission with severe abdominal pain, and where they have to be in the hospital, where they might end up having surgery to remove intestine. And what they've done is really fascinating. They've actually started to look at the use of the iPhone and their communication with these, a lot of times they're teenagers, and seeing and actually monitoring their use of that iPhone. And then they can see, look, Joey is waking up a lot in the middle of the night because they can see it now, and then they have some communication. And so they text him, hey, Joey, you been waking up in the middle of the night? Oh, I didn't notice that. Well, they notice that because they can monitor their use of the phone. The phone has become such a big part of our lives.
That's interesting.
And so what they've found is that they can bring these patients in and like there's something going on here. Give them a therapy and then they see that goes away. They're now sleeping through the night. That's just one of the examples. But I think here's that here we are. We're connecting with our patients.
Yeah.
We're using the technology to connect. We're using the technology to actually now real-time follow what we never could real-time follow before. And then we're seeing better care.
You know, the sense I get from the three of you this morning is there always has been something of a wall between doctors and their patients, and you guys want to break down that wall and remove some of the stigma, the stereotypes that separate doctors from their patients, Natasha. Am I hearing you right?
I think that's exactly right, Steve. And I always kind of think of myself as an old-time physician. I really want to know my patients. I go to their homes. I go to their birthday parties. I go to all of those types of places. And I don't think what I do is any different than the doctors of the early 1900s who you would see at church, who you would see at the park, who would be president of every council in your town, that you would see them, you would interact with them, and you'd be sidelining them with questions. I'm just doing that on a different medium. It's the same exact thing.
We were talking a minute ago about this idea of the economic impact this could have, maybe in a negative way. But Dr. Natasha, you've written about the impact all of this has had on your practice. And one thing you write about is the financial inducement on the positive side. You wrote that social media was helping you average one new patient family per week who came because of our social media presence. And I know this because they tell me, you wrote in a column, you added 52 new patients a year, $2,700 an average pediatric care for 0 to 24-month-olds. That's $140,000 a year of average billable income over 2 years. That's some significant money.
Very significant money.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, that's not why I do it. I mean, it doesn't matter to me whether a patient comes in the door or not. But I would say that at this point, that was written and those numbers were kind of looked at over a couple of years ago. And I think it's even more, the numbers are more significant than that. I think to add what the guys were saying, too, about use of time and use of resources, by having these tools and the limited time that I have in my day, I think I can follow my patients better. I think I can improve their health care and make them more comfortable with the care that they're providing at home by having this access and not having them come into the office. It does save me time for the people that really need to see me on that day, but I still think more of my patients know that I care about them, that I'm thinking about them, and they can communicate with me even when they're not in the office. And to me, that's worth more than any office visit could be.
Josh, here again, you know, how many times, and this has been written about too, this idea that a family or a patient comes to see one of you guys and there's a conversation and there's some instruction given by the doctor about how the patient should care for him or herself going forward. And the patient gets home, and I've been in this boat 100 times, and my wife will say, well, you know, what did the doctor say about what you're supposed to be doing going forward? And you've forgotten point A and point D, and you remember point B and point C, and you wish you could text your doctor very quickly and say, hey, remind me again what I'm supposed to do about X, right? I mean, that happens all the time.
Absolutely, absolutely. I think it's one of the things that we really struggle with in medicine is how to make sure that that patient is following through with what we want them to do when they get home. When they leave my office, you know, it's a partnership with patients coming up with treatments and then trying to ensure that they're following through with those treatments. And I think electronic tools and online communication can really help in furthering that goal. Because you're right, you end up at home and have no idea what to do. I was working with the physician at Children's Mercy on a project that he's really passionate about with asthma action plans. Now, these are sheets of paper that they hand to patients when they go home and how to take their asthma treatments based on the severity of their symptoms.
Great example. Yeah.
Well, these patients go home and they lose that piece of paper and then it's gone. And, you know, then what do you do?
Mm-hmm.
Worst case scenario, you end up back in the emergency room because you weren't able to adequately control your asthma symptoms. So I think we can, again, this notion of putting up information for our patients to use. And then down the road, I see us really capitalizing on mobile technologies like cell phones. Can I have my asthma action plan on my cell phone and pull it up and say, oh, I'm in my yellow zone. These are the three things that I need to do.
And this is the kind of stuff you're working on and some of the research that you're doing, if I understand right. How can technology boost patient health going forward?
Yes, it's my main area of interest right now. Unfortunately, as a medical student, I don't have a whole lot of spare time to be working on projects like this. But yeah, it's something that I'm constantly thinking about. And when I'm moving around from these different offices and seeing these different patient contexts, I'm always trying to think of ways which we can improve this and looking for different avenues to accomplish those goals.
I mean, it should be known. I mean, what Josh has done. So Josh has actually worked with me before medical school and then actually took a year again to work with us at Children's Mercy Hospital. And the reason for that work is really what we're talking about was we had developed clinical practice guidelines to help with here's the evidence base or the evidence that suggests here's how we should treat. And in this case, it was pneumonia. And Josh actually came to me in 2000, probably 9 or 10, and says, hey, you should develop an app for your clinical practice guideline for pneumonia, right? So the best way, and I'm like, you got to be crazy. I mean, I don't know how to do that. No, and I think I told him no maybe 3 or 4 times. But Josh, being the persistent medical student now and at the time a colleague and working with me, showed me a PowerPoint. And the next thing we know, a year later, we have a what is in the App Store. It's free. It's called CAP Guideline. And any physician or any clinician, anybody, can go and download this guideline that is our clinical practice guideline on how to take care of pneumonia.
That makes so much sense to me.
Absolutely.
Particularly for something as complicated as pneumonia and asthma and the issues you're talking about,
and it's
Josh.
A wonderful tool for those of us in the community because then we can take the work that they have done in the current research, the current directions. I can go into my pocket as a community physician and know that my children's hospital and ID experts are supporting this treatment plan for my patients. And so that using those tools as doctor-to-doctor communication are also quite vital.
That's so interesting.
So just to clarify, there's kind of two issues here. One is providing resources for physicians to use, which is what we did at Children's Mercy. And the other is providing resources for patients to use.
Right.
And what you will see, you know, if you go and look in the App Store around a lot of these medical apps that are around, you'll see that there's quite a few people working very hard on developing patient-centered tools to improve patient care and give them resources. There's some work on the physician side, but that's one of my areas of primary interest and where I think that there can be a lot of improvement. And it's something that, yeah, Jason and I have been working on.
I mean,
there's a business there, Josh. If you need some help, call me. Sounds like it's got some promise.
Well, he does, yeah. And I will say that, you know, there's data that suggests that physicians use about 50% of the evidence that's out there. So good evidence that suggests we should treat this way. They use about 50%.
That's interesting.
Then there's another data that suggests that patients, families then will utilize that recommended treatment plan or recommend is up 50% of the time. So you take that 50% times 50%, right? Yeah. So you got only 25% of the time is a patient likely getting a evidence, right, data, research done to suggest that that will work.
If you're just joining us this morning, you're listening to Up to Date. We're talking about this big revolution in doctor communication, doctors using email, texting, tweeting, and Facebook. If you have a relationship with your doctor that involves any of those things and can tell us how it's worked for you, 816-235-2888 is our phone number, our email address, uptodate@kcur.org. Mandy from Shawnee, good morning.
Good morning.
Hi.
Hi. I have a little bit different take on that because I'm actually a home health physical therapist, and we have some of our physicians that now communicate through email, which is much simpler for us as well. You know, if we're calling, a lot of times we just have to call and have them call us back, only I'm with a patient and they can't talk right now, and so it ends up being this huge phone tag game, whereas with the email, I can put my concerns in, send it to them. They don't have to listen to, you know, all these emails and make notes. They just glance at their emails between patients and send us an answer, and it's a much more effective way for communicating.
Mandy, that's a great call. I'm glad to have it. Thanks for making the effort.
Yeah, thanks.
Yeah, I bet. Bye-bye. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our good conversation about doctors tweeting and texting. Again, your phone calls welcome, 816-235-2888. Later on this hour, Brian McTavish is back with your weekend to-do list. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. If you missed yesterday's conversation about commuter rail in Jackson County with County Executive Mike Sanders and our talk about Kansas lawmakers misunderstanding the state's laws, you can find it at kcur.org. On tomorrow's program, we'll take a look at a KC Honky Tonk Roadhouse Saloon. It's called Knuckleheads. We'll check in with the Poet Laureate of Kansas and hear a new installment of A Fan's Notes. This hour, we're talking about a new revolution in medicine. It involves social media, doctors emailing, texting, tweeting, and using Facebook to communicate with their doctors. With our patients, we're visiting with Dr. Natasha Burgert with Pediatric Associates, Dr. Jason Newland with Children's Mercy, and Josh Harrigan, who's a medical student at the KU School of Medicine, who's been working on these issues. Again, our phone number, 816-235-2888. Let's go to some calls here, and Cole from Leawood. Cole, good morning.
Good morning. I'm a neurointerventional specialist. I practice a surgical practice doing procedures of the blood vessels of the brain. And I found enormous curiosity amongst our patients in Kansas City for these types of procedures. As such, I've started posting some of the procedures on YouTube. And this has, I think, been a lot of fun for the patients who've participated and also for patients who are considering treatment of a brain condition such as an aneurysm. This is something I started about 3 years ago, and we've had now we're in the tens of thousands of views. I find that patients who look into this are much better informed about their condition.
Yeah, good suggestion, good idea, Cole. I'm glad to hear you're getting good response from it.
Yeah, you know, I think it, you know, Cole, and just to respond to that, I think when you're able to put this information out around, you know, procedures and stuff, it, coming from these knowledgeable, reputable sources where they know and you can trust it. I think Natasha's had a lot of good experience with that. I know myself as a, you know, infectious diseases physician, you know, there can be a lot of things out there that can really take to have people going in the wrong direction. We all know that the internet can have a lot of things that you don't know what can you believe and what can't you believe. Mm-hmm. And I'd like to say that, you know, obviously you go to Dr. Burgert's blog, you know you're getting the right information. I know that. I can see that. You come to the, you know, a Children's Mercy Hospital sponsor thing, it's going to be the right information. So we have to be in this space. We just have to continue to improve this stuff.
And a reminder, then, you're saying, too, Jason, that a lot of junk is floating around out there on the Internet.
Yes, exactly.
Natasha's nodding her head, too. Email here from Brooke, who writes us this, up to date at kcur.org. I'm a nurse, and I do text my family physician regarding my children. He gives me feedback and lets me know what direction to take. He has advised me at different times to head on into the ER with a kid with a concussion, monitor and come in the morning for an appointment, and has called out prescriptions for me. It's a helpful and it increases my satisfaction as a mother to be able to do all this. You know, what about the privacy concerns, though? I mean, you know, tweeting, sometimes tweets go public. We've all seen many examples of that in society any number of times. Facebook information, oftentimes very public. How do you balance that concern here, Natasha?
Well, I think it's important for families to understand that we respect their privacy to the utmost. And my goal with Facebook, my goal with Twitter, is not to practice medicine online. My goal is to share a positive and hopefully encouraging healthcare message. And so when things do happen to come my way that seem like they would be on the verge of violating someone's personal privacy, and that's to my discretion with my experience, we take that conversation offline.
And you do it offline how? By a private tweet or email? Or?
Well, it depends on where it's coming from. Most of the situations where people are feel, I would say, more comfortable to disclosing information seems to be Facebook. That's very easy for us to see the Facebook user. We know they're a patient. We find their phone number. We give them a call.
Now, you had an interesting situation not long ago. You got a text from a patient you described as a beautiful teen girl with bright eyes and dark fingernails, Natasha, and she wrote you this: I do have something I want to talk to you about. You just told my mom that she can read my text messages. I really didn't like that. This is a violation of my right to privacy, and it is none of your business. How did you respond to that?
I responded by saying
This girl was a minor,
yeah,
I gather.
As a young person, if you're putting something in a public place, then you have already given away your right to privacy. If you want something private, put it in a diary.
And she gave you this information. How? How did you?
I talk about social media, texting, cell phones, Facebook, all of these different things with my teenagers when they come in. This is how they're communicating with their friends. This is how they're living their life. And there's no line between their real life and their online life anymore. It's becoming a mush.
In this case, you had texted this young girl?
Yes, mm-hmm. Because I was seeing things in the office that I was concerned about. These were issues that we discussed as a family or with her family when they're in the office, and this conversation continued later. I had already been invited into that space in order to help this girl with some other problems. I want to emphasize that it's not that I randomly text my teenagers. I'm not going to seek my patients out if I've not already been invited in that space. Mm-hmm. But I think a lot of parents are struggling with how to navigate this online world that their kids are fully involved in. And so I feel that they're looking for help and looking for someone else to be involved at times.
Let's go back to some phone calls here. Let's go to Brian from Shawnee. Brian, you're on Up to Date. Good morning.
Hi, how you doing?
Well,
I'm a IT guy. I've been doing consulting in the healthcare space for a lot of years. And, you know, people are talking a lot about, you know, Mandy called in and made mention of, you know, that they email back and forth. And I think technology is a great enabler for some of those. But something to keep in mind from an information security perspective, email, for instance, is all clear text across the Internet. So a lot of people, you know, use it out of convenience and don't necessarily realize the impact of that. A great example, I used to consult over in St. Louis, and there's a very large, well-known hospital over there, that one of the things that we discovered during an assessment was that all the radiology and imaging that was being done and all the transcription was being sent to, you know, Hotmail accounts to these transcriptionists, and it had Social Security numbers, mm-hmm. It had patient addresses, full patient names, and this was every read that they were doing and every transcription that they were doing in the hospital. So, I mean, the potential for identity theft and things like that are just astronomical. So I would, a word to the wise, I would make sure that everybody out there, make sure they understand the implications of the communication and the way that they're sharing these patients' information.
Yeah, points well taken, Brian. Thank you for the phone call. I appreciate it. Let's go to Christine.
Gotcha.
Let's go to Christine from Kansas City, Missouri. Christine, I just lost her. I'm sorry. Christine, call back. Ken from Overland Park, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
Hi, Ken.
How are you all doing?
Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, I work for a large physician group here in Kansas City. I'm the trainer and corporate compliance officer for Encompass Medical Group. I don't know if I could say that, but what we do, I'm sorry if I did, I apologize. We have 9 clinics with about 48 plus providers. And what we do is we have a patient portal, and you're able to, when you come in, if you have the ability to utilize a computer, get a special PIN, password, and go through a secure website to get information from your medical records. And also, we're a patient-centered medical home where we work with our patients to ensure that they meet the and exceed their outcomes. They need to actually be committed, be part of the team, and we invite them to have themselves as well as other family members with them to commit towards reaching their goals, whether it be hyperlipidemia, hypertension, diabetes, I mean, throughout the entire gamut. So what we do is we get buy-in from the patients, and so they're able to, you know, not only get information. Our doctors are totally, across the board have EMRs. We're able to print patient information. We have information on our website that allows them to go through, and they can get their labs. They can go and see various types of information that they need, whether it's a pediatric patient from a parent standpoint or a guardian standpoint, all the way through people who are getting older, like myself, and have the ability to gain access to a computer.
Yeah, no, I was going to say, you know, Ken, I think that's it's great. And I think, you know, even at Children's Mercy, we're starting to develop these patient portals. And I think these are the way we need to get more of. It's just more this family engagement or patient engagement, or the buzzword now is patient-centered care. That we're all supposed to be reaching and striving for patient-centered care or family-centered care more with pediatrics, so that we're not just saying, okay, you go do this. It's more of, okay, we think you should do this. Let's. How do you think we're going to do that? And here's our information. And by the way, this is your information. You should be able to get on and do that. And I think with patient portals that I think I was Cole before talking about kind of the risks that you take by doing some emails and stuff, that that hospitals and big clinics are realizing they have to set up the security so that we can do that. Because like we've talked about pretty much, you know, most of this hour, is that that's going to lead to better outcomes. It has to.
Yeah, I'm just wondering about patients, though, who don't have smartphones, can't afford them. Patients who don't have computers at home because they can't afford them. I mean, there's a whole, obviously, a group in society that can't access what we're talking about today. What about them, Natasha?
It's amazing as we're kind of watching technology develop, because I would agree that there's so many patients that don't have a personal home computer, but can come to the library and still get access. What is interesting too is, especially in the harder reached populations, the young teens, the Latinos, African American populations, the urban core, they may not have access to these technologies specifically, but someone in their peer group usually has a smartphone. And a lot of since smartphones are becoming so easy to access, they're being really a focus of research to reach those areas that traditionally aren't going to have access, even to the plains of Africa, using smartphones to get technology and information out to them.
Sherry posts this on KCUR's Facebook page. Never mind texting the doctor. I'd just be thrilled if I could just schedule an appointment online. I always seem to get transferred half a dozen times, and it takes forever to get something set up. You know, Josh Harrigan, I'm wondering about another issue that's arisen that sort of turns the table on the medical profession a little bit. NPR just had a story that raised these questions. Is it okay for your doctor to tweet a drunken photograph of him or herself? Or what if the photo shows a doctor drinking, say, at a staff holiday party, but is not noticeably under the influence? These are issues that doctors increasingly have to deal with, too.
Yeah, and there was a JAMA study, I think, a couple of years ago, where they asked medical schools if their students had inappropriately used social media. And 60% of them said that they had had an instance of that at their schools. Now, there were a few caveats to that survey, but it does happen. you have to realize that social media is a public space, and you need to comport yourself as you would in any other public space. And I think as long as you have some sensibility to it and understand that what you put out there can be seen by anybody, I don't think you should run into very many problems.
Jason Newland, there are some serious repercussions, though, for doctors Absolutely. Who are inappropriately seen on online doing something they shouldn't be doing, like, you know, looking drunk at an office Christmas party.
Absolutely. You know, we take this profession as, you know, we're looked upon in society as kind of an upper echelon, you could say sophisticated, however you want, but we're held up to a different standard in some respects. While I think Natasha and Josh and Will say that we want to be just like everybody else and talk and want you to talk to us, we hold ourselves to that higher standard, and we should. Mm-hmm. And if we plan on taking care of their family or their child, them, I think it's upon us as physicians, clinicians, to behave and know that these things can be out there. And, you know, I think about all the examples just recently in the news, right? You think Manti Te'o mm-hmm. and all these people that are young folks, but they are in the limelight and they know that, you know, that the way you handle yourself is going to have repercussions, and you have to remember that. I think I was lucky to, you know, meet up with some great mentors along the years that says, you know, when you write something, it's there forever.
Yeah.
Be careful. Because yeah. you're going to be into situations. You just have to think and be smart.
If you just think for a moment, Natasha, if you're a doctor and you're wearing your scrubs and you're holding a drink, that can begin to imply very quickly that you may have been drinking on the job, which, of course, is the last thing on earth. What are some of the consequences for doctors who might be expose themselves in this way?
I think the consequences really vary because this is kind of a wild wilderness. Nobody really knows what to do.
So the there aren't clear standards
right, there's
in some
not clear
cases.
Standards. So in some cases, it might just be, please don't do this. I'd really like you for to take that photo down. Or a great example was at Johnson County Community College a few years back, where an inappropriate picture was taken on Facebook and a student was asked to leave the program. She's no longer in that program because of a Facebook photo. So I think the disciplinary actions are still kind of being decided.
To what extent are you guys warned about this kind of stuff with some regularity? I imagine it's got to come up occasionally.
You know, one of my roles at the hospital is medical director of patient safety. And so, you know, while that feeds into some of this, right, because I think we have to hold ourselves accountable for that patient safety, we hear about it, right? I mean, that's
–
and the consequences can be, I think, up to the point of you can be terminated. I consider myself – you know, yeah, I represent myself, my family, but I'm a big representative of Children's Mercy Hospital. You know, it's a big deal that I can come and talk about this to you all, because that helps, you know, with our hospital, and I think it's an important part of our image. So we do hear about it. Did we hear about it enough? I would suggest that if we're going to get more into this space, which we should, I think we probably should hear about it more.
Hmm. Well, such an interesting conversation. We are out of time. I want to thank you all for coming in and joining us today. Such a good conversation. Dr. Natasha Burgert, who's with Pediatric Associates of Kansas City, Dr. Jason Newland with Children's Mercy, and Josh Harrigan, who's a medical student at the KU School of Medicine. Thank you all very much for coming in. So good to have you here.
Thank you.
Thanks
for
having
us.